I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Angela Duckworth's father constantly told her when she was growing up that she was no genius and worried that it would limit her ability to achieve in school and in life. A few years ago, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, often referred to as a genius grant, for her work on something she calls grit. When she was a seventh grade math teacher, she noticed that the students who got the best grades were often the ones who worked the hardest, not the ones with a natural talent for numbers or the so-called smartest kids in the room. That got her thinking about success, and she began to do research to find out what it entails. She concluded that it involves, quote, passion and perseverance for long-term goals, in other words, grit. That's the title of her new book. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, joining us once again on Radio Times to talk about grit. And Angela Duckworth, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So did you write this book to prove your father wrong?
You know, I wrote this book reluctantly, to be completely honest. I felt like if I write a book, I'm going to be taking away time from science. And I was, like any scientist, hesitant to actually make recommendations to parents and teachers about what I thought they should do. You know, science is all about how you could possibly be wrong. And here I'm trying to tell people what I think is actually right.
What does your father say, though?
Your
book begins.
I have to say that it was also a bit of ambivalence about, you know, telling the story of growing up with a dad who, you know, like any dad, had his imperfections. And my father was singularly obsessed for his entire life. He's still alive. He lives not far from Center City, Philadelphia, in a nursing home, but singularly obsessed with achievement. And it's absolutely accurate to say that he would say that I was no Einstein, that I was no Newton, that I was no genius. And my wife, my mom, who was an artist, he would say, out of the blue, you're no Picasso. And I felt ambivalent about telling that story to people outside of our family. But the one thing my father's always been and still is today is honest. And he, I think, is completely fine with me saying what I think and has always been. And I did read him this book. And he's in late stages of Parkinson's. I don't know how much penetrated, but he seemed to smile.
But you raised the question, and I don't think it's just your father, that there is so much focus on things like talent or natural talent or smartness or IQ or intelligence, whatever we call it. You're really pushing back on that.
You know, it's not that I don't think talent exists, right? I mean, you could hold the view that we're all tabula rasa, that we're all completely equal, and there's nothing to say about talent at all. I think that's an ideal and actually inaccurate view. Some people get better at things faster than others, certain things, of course. The thing that I want to say is that talent is, to some extent, a distraction from the work itself. And if kids walk around in elementary school thinking, I'm not in the gifted and talented program, and therefore I'm not going to achieve something in life, then I think that's an incredibly dangerous distraction.
Well, thinking about, we could do a whole hour on just what intelligence is and what it isn't. You just rolled your eyes at me.
I did.
Because that's a rabbit hole it's possible to go down and never come out of. But is there too much focus on this notion even of IQ, of whatever that number is?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that happens when we are able to count something, and it's that it ends up counting, right? I mean, the fact that you can, you know, put a number on your SAT score. I mean, there are so many adults that I know in life who have memorized their SAT score. They're in their, like, 40s, and they still know exactly what they got. And, you know, the fact that that can be so indelibly part of your identity, I think, says something about the power of one test that you took on one day when you were a teenager. Same thing with IQ. The fact that we can put a number on it, I think, maybe enlarges its significance. And I will say this, we should have another Radio Times on intelligence, because to be perfectly honest, as a psychologist, the more I study and think about IQ and intelligence, you know, sometimes I feel like the less I really, at a core level, understand it.
Well, maybe we will do that at some later date. Talk, though, about grit. And I gave your definition of grit, passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. Grit is a kind of old-fashioned word. I think of stick-to-itiveness. I think of working hard, not giving up, all part of grit?
Absolutely, but only half of grit. So I think that the idea that, you know, perseverance and hard work are what pay off, you know, Calvin Coolidge said it, and before Calvin Coolidge, a lot of other people said it. But I think that's only the half of grit that's obvious. The other half of grit is having a passion for something. I mean, I can't tell you how many paragons of grit, you know, real exemplars, people like Jane Golden right here in Philadelphia.
The mural arts program.
I mean, you simply will not meet another person as gritty as Jane Golden. Mark Vetri, the great chef of Philadelphia, you know, Roberto Diaz, who runs Curtis here in the city. You know, all of these people will tell you in the first 5 minutes of conversation, I love what I do. I love what I do. It is enduringly fascinating to me, and it is deeply important, and I know it matters to other people. That's the passion part of grit that I think is just as important.
But which comes first? I mean, does the passion come and then the grit follow, or does the grit create the passion?
I think that to some extent you say that passion comes first in the following way. You know, when you look at children, and you know, you have to go back, you have to kind of ask, you know, what was Roberto Diaz like as a kid? What was Jane like as a kid? You know, you have to ask, you know, whether they were really, really hardworking and working on their weaknesses, constantly driven to improve in even microscopic ways, resilient in the face of adversity. You have to ask whether that came first or this enduring fascination for their topic. And in fact, developmentally, it's typically that interest precedes this, disciplined work ethic and so forth. So I think it's important to remember, you know, especially if there are any parents listening, that, you know, you want to make sure that there's a spark of interest in what kids are doing and not assume that and then, you know, immediately fast forward them, skipping over the interest phase into practice and work.
You look at a number of different people, including some of these very young spelling bee competitors, some of them champions, and the kind of, I mean, I don't even think grit describes the kind of almost obsessive focus on language and learning words and expanding their vocabulary and frankly devoting hours and hours and hours and hours to being a spelling bee contender or champion. Is that how we should think about grit? Because that seems way over on the scale over here.
Well, now these kids in the National Spelling Bee are between the ages of 7 and 14. And you're exactly right that they spend, you know, almost unimaginable numbers of, you know, hours working on Saturdays, on Sunday. And remember, they're still in school. So while they're practicing for the spelling bee, they're still in school for most of the day. It's remarkable. And you might say, oh my gosh, my 8-year-old isn't spending hours every Saturday doing anything like that. They're unusual. I mean, they're only 275 in the whole country each year. Last night at the Philadelphia Library, I gave a talk and I met one of them. She was actually in one of my studies and she remembered taking the grit scale. And she's actually friends with the champion that year, Carrie Close, who's now a young woman becoming a journalist. Let me say this. Those kids in the National Spelling Bee are remarkable in at least two ways. They really do have a passion for words, for language. They love word roots and so forth. And two, they really do have an unusual capacity for the kind of hard practice which is unusual at that age. But I do think by looking at outliers in grit, you can reverse engineer, and not that we all have to be in the National Spelling Bee or all need to run as fast as Usain Bolt, but we can learn from those kids and paragons of grit who are in adulthood and say, well, what are they doing? What are their habits? What do they believe? What are their attitudes? Who are their mentors? So that we can, in our own lives, our ordinary lives maybe, achieve a little more excellence.
You mentioned the grit scale. I have it in front of me. I took it.
How'd you do?
I did about 3.9.
Oh, interesting.
Not terrific.
Yeah.
But no, not bad. Yeah. Not bad. And these are, it's a series of statements, and you answer them yourself. And it's the scale is very much like me at the top, not like me at all, comparing ourselves to other people. The first one says, new ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones. Second one, setbacks don't discourage me. I don't give up easily. Third, I often set a goal but later choose to pursue a different one. Fourth, I'm a hard worker. What are you trying to get at with these statements?
So the scale has two kinds of questions, and in the four that you just read, two of them were about being a hard worker and being resilient. I mean, you know, staying in something as opposed to dropping out and working very hard while you're there. That's perseverance. The other two questions were about the consistency of your interests over time. You know, how often you change direction, or importantly for me, how often often you don't change direction, right? And those are the passion items. So to the extent that you are both a hard worker and resilient and also working in a consistent direction, well, then I would say you're gritty.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but how do you, I mean, how do you tease out grit? You mentioned the word resilience, and I'm thinking about competitiveness. I'm thinking about all the other features that we might associate with something like grit.
Well, I do think to some extent grit is a kind of like a composite. It's sort of, you know, not just one thing that makes you gritty, but several. And I used to work in a lab at Harvard when I was an undergraduate under a very distinguished developmental psychologist named Jerry Kagan. He was the chair of the department at that time. And we spoke recently and he yelled at me, as he was wont. It was like being spoken to in all capital letters. It's like, Angela, are you listening, Angela? Angela, are you listening? Yes, Jerry, I'm listening. He's like, you know, grit's not one thing, it's many things. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, part of grit is being resilient and not giving up hope. Part of grit is having the discipline to work daily on refinements to make your craft better. Part of grit is having a passion that's interesting to you intrinsically. And part of grit is having an occupation that you find meaningful. I mean, I'm guessing that the people here at WHYY feel like their work matters. It's not just interesting, it's important. So that's part of grit too.
You also have found that grittiness, this is the word associated with grit, that it seems to grow with age. Can I put it that way?
Yes,
the older people are, the grittier they are.
In my data, I have now thousands and thousands of grit scores on thousands and thousands of adults of all ages, and you find this very clear pattern where the older you are, the grittier you are. Grit and age go hand in hand. My question when looking at this data was, well, like, what's wrong with these millennials? You know, why are they so ungritty? And I'll tell you the most popular answer. If you ask any audience, they'll say, well, millennials are so ungritty because they grew up with social media. You know, they grew up without the messages that hard work really matters. They have an impatience that is, you know, the product of their generation. And there is another explanation. And actually, if you look in aggregate at all the data that's been collected on the development of character strengths like grit over age, the data favor a second alternative explanation, and that is that we grow up, that these 20-somethings that are annoying to us because they haven't learned to work hard and they're not resilient enough and that they haven't experienced enough of life's lessons to become the way we are when we are in our middle age. And so I think that what's wrong with millennials isn't necessarily entirely their culture, but to a large extent, the fact that they haven't grown up yet.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but the idea that boomers were millennials when they were the same age.
And all of the data suggests that the boomers, when they were the same age as the millennials, were more like millennials than they remember.
That is Angela Duckworth, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. And for the last number of years, she's been doing a lot of research on this notion, this idea of grit, stick-to-itiveness, passion, and perseverance. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Are you gritty? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Angela Duckworth. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a new book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. How do you think, and you do have this scale, there's a character scale that you have developed as well, and there has been some pushback on that, but have these kinds of scales and measurements, have they been misused from your perspective?
I think that when people ask the question, is this scale valid, they're asking a very straightforward and common sense question, which is, can I use this? Does it actually measure grit? But as a scientist, we always ask a question that goes a little farther. Is this scale valid for the particular use I want to use it for? So I think that the grit scale is valid for two uses. It is valid for research. You know, you can give this scale to spellers in the National Spelling Bee or cadets at West Point. You can take their scores and you can see whether they predict things like how well people do. That's taking lots and lots of people's scores, averaging them together, and coming to look at a pattern of data. And by the way, in my research studies, there's really zero incentive to fake your score because your score just gets sucked into my database and nobody else sees it. But now let's talk about a use that I don't believe in, which is grading schools and teachers on grit and punishing or rewarding them based on these self-report questionnaires. That's a use for which I don't think the grit scale is valid. Before I turn it back to you, I just want to say one other thing that it's valid for, not just research, but self-reflection. I met a coach recently named Anson Dorrance, and he is the coach of the UNC Tar Heels women's soccer team, the winningest team in NCAA history. And Anson told me, to my surprise, that he was giving the scale to his players every year. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Why? And he said, it's for them to know what I mean as a coach when I say that I want them to be gritty. And it's for them to just reflect on how they stand and how they stand relative to last year and where they'd like to be next year. So for self-reflection and for research, absolutely valid. For other uses, I'm really not sure.
Well, I wonder whether it's a danger of interpreting lack of grittiness or ungrittiness as laziness. And there has been some pushback on this saying, yes, if you're a middle class kid and you don't have to worry about, you know, dodging bullets going back and forth to school, sure, you can probably be gritty and you can develop some of these talents and these skills because you don't have to worry about perhaps a dangerous neighborhood or problems at home or a parent that works two jobs and they're not around to help you out. What do you say to that?
I think it's a real worry of mine. And I will tell you that I've actually quite literally spent nights awake thinking and worrying about whether the message of grit would be misinterpreted as, you know, poor kids are lazy. And, you know, I have yet another reason to say that schools don't have a responsibility to do something here. You know, children are all of our responsibility. You know, if a kid's not working hard, I mean, first of all, I think we should acknowledge, you know, they're not working hard. Let's not say that they are, but let's always try as the grown-ups in the room to ask why that kid isn't working hard and what can I do to help them? How do I help them focus here? Now, let me just tell you about one research finding which is related to this. Several years ago, I started collecting data on negative life events in the lives of children. Things like my parents are fighting a lot, or, you know, my parents are splitting up, or, you know, somebody in my family lost a job, somebody's sick. If you count up the number of negative life events in a child's life and you ask the question, what influence does that on that child's grit, their self-control, their character, you get the following incredibly reliable finding, which is that the more stressful life events in a child's life, the more upset they are, the more negative emotion they feel. And that in turn predicts decreases in things like self-control and grit. So it's not either or, you know, either we should worry about kids' situations or we should cultivate their character. It's absolutely both and.
Mike Rose had a piece, and he's been a guest on the show in the past. He put together what he called, he didn't come up with a perfect word for it, but he called it an impediment score. The questions, again, very much like me, not like me at all. I always have bus fare to get to school. I hear my parents talking about not having enough money for the rent. Whenever I get sick, I'm able to go to a doctor. We always have enough food in our home. I worry about getting to school safely. Underscoring what you just said there, which is for a number of children, this is the world that they live in.
It's absolutely right. And I don't think our world is fair, and it doesn't look by the statistic like it's getting any fairer. So, you know, I absolutely empathize with this perspective. I really do. And I'm trying to keep my ears open as a scientist to, you know, what I've gotten wrong myself. But I will say that even in my own data, I see the exact same pattern, which is when kids are beleaguered by, you know, so many obstacles that they aren't able to handle at that young age with the resources and the skills that they have, they obviously don't do things in the classroom that we want them to do, like pay attention and, you know, try another math problem, even though they're frustrated. So again, you know, I think that, you know, my mission in life really is to help kids. And I'll betray my own, I guess, allegiance, which is that I care the most about the kids who have the least. And so for sure, we should not ignore these obstacles. They're almost impossible to talk about, you know, without considering that the that both grit and opportunity are intertwined. I mean, they're just braided together and you can't separate them.
As you were describing what too many children have to deal with, I was thinking of that psychological principle, learned helplessness. You know, you get shocked enough and you kind of give up. Is that what you're talking about?
I am. And, you know, there's a history of learned helplessness that really starts in Philadelphia almost exactly 50 years ago to the day. And that is the work of Marty Seligman, who is my PhD advisor and still is at Penn, and his collaborator, Steve Mayer, who's now in Colorado. But in these experiments, as you know, Marty, the finding is this. When you have animals that experience uncontrollable shock or stress, that itself is what precipitates a helplessness response. They learn something, and they learn that they can't control their lives. And if you look at the conditions in which too many children are growing up, it's exactly that. Mm-hmm. Things happen, they're bad, they're unpredictable, the kids have no control over it. It's no wonder that they grow up without hope.
So how do you help a child under those circumstances develop the kind of skills or even mindset that helps them be more resilient, perhaps even overcome some of this stuff?
You know, I think the one thing that we should keep in mind is that you can't expect the child to do any of this on their own, right? There's no parent listening who would imagine that they would let their kids grow up without their oversight, without their support. So for the kids who are growing up in circumstances that none of us would wish upon them, I think we need to broaden our definition of parent. You know, the root of parent, I mean, if you look at its original meaning, it means to bring forth. And maybe some of these kids in their immediate neighborhood or circumstances don't have the grown-ups who are bringing forth their best. But then we should expand our definition. Like, who are the parents of this kid? Their teachers are the parents. Sometimes it's a pastor. Sometimes it's an uncle or a grandparent, a math teacher. I'll tell you about one kid who emailed me out of the blue. He was just on the cusp of graduating from MIT with a 3.9 perfect, nearly perfect grade point average in electrical engineering and in computer science. He grew up near Camden, not far from here, in really the most impoverished circumstances. And when I got to know this kid named Cody, and I asked him, Cody Coleman, whom I love, just love. And I asked him, you know, how he got to be where he was. You know, there were people along the way, not actually either of his parents biologically, but an older brother who encouraged him that he could go to college, a mother who he would say, now he calls her mom, but it's his math teacher. You know, her name is Chantel, and I just saw her a couple weeks ago. She wanted to buy me bookends as a celebration of the book. That's the kind of person she is. She got him to the orthodontist to take his braces off his teeth when his parents didn't have the wherewithal to. She bought him his socks and his sweaters when he went to college. She is the mother to whom he comes home on holidays. She is the first one to ever give him a birthday party. So for those kids who grow up in disadvantage, and I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture here that it's easy, but it's really all of our responsibility to parent them.
And that's Angela Duckworth, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. A couple of years ago, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for some of the research, some of the work that she's been doing on something that she calls grit. And that happens to be the title of her new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Looks like we have Liz from Center City, Philadelphia joining us. Liz, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is, can grit become pathological, as in savantism or autism? And is there a physiological aspect to this grittiness? Is it another one of these prefrontal cortex functions that we hear so much about?
Interesting question, and both you and I kind of reacted when Liz talked about autism as pathological, because I think what we're learning is that it's on this continuum, the scale. But go ahead, Angela.
You know, I won't pretend to be an expert in autism because I'm not. I know very little about it. I will say that I interviewed Temple Grandin, actually, while doing research for this book, and many listeners will know that she's a wonderful, accomplished author and also somebody who writes a lot about her own autism. And I'll just quote her. She said, you know, Angela, a little bit of obsession gets your work done. You know, she was joking, I think, which is interesting because in her own adult life, she's actually evolved and, you know, she can actually make a joke now, which I didn't think she would even by her own admission, say was not possible early on. So I won't say very much about autism, except to say that I don't think it's the same thing as grit. And I don't even know that if you take, you know, grit to an extreme, if you look at people like Jane Golden or, you know, Michael Baim, he's another Philadelphian here who's, you know, a paragon of grit that I've been studying. I wouldn't call either of them, you know, on the spectrum. So I think that we can say that, you know, they're maybe not mutually exclusive. It's possible to be both, but I don't think they're the same thing either. The second question you asked was about the biology of grit. You know, is this another thing that we can say is part of the prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain that develops later in life? It matures more slowly than any other part of the brain and seems to be the seat of something else that I study, which is self-control and delay of gratification. There's not enough data, but I'll tell you that a few weeks ago, there was a leading neuroscientist who did a presentation in our lab, and he came all the way from Sweden to tell me that when they scan brains of people who are high and low grit, they don't find differences in the prefrontal cortex. They actually find differences in much lower order brain areas that are the seat of motivation. So it could be that grit is not actually the same as self-control in the neurobiological sense, but that there's some other part of the brain that is its basis.
Does that raise questions about nature and nurture?
Well, you know, the thing is to tell the listeners is that, you know, in 60 seconds, I can tell you everything you need to know about nature and nurture, which is everything about you, everything, your IQ, your height, whether you like chicken, if you're going to vote Republican or Democrat in the fall, is both nature and nurture. There's nothing that's been studied that doesn't have some heritable component. There's nothing that's been studied that isn't influenced, at least to some degree, and in many cases, like grit, to a large degree, by life experience.
Let me get Jonna from Lancaster to join us. Jonna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I love that I come in after nature and nurture because I think that as moms, there's such a tendency to think that I have so much power over this new baby that I have in my life. And my 8-year-old, I'm really trying to push the nickname Grit onto him. I love that there's someone interviewed in the book who goes by the name Grit. And because he is a gritty kid, my Kenton is resisting it because even before he was born, my Kenton came out of the womb with the cord wrapped around his neck twice and tied in a knot.
Wow.
And I feel like I should have learned the lesson then that this kid is never going to need motivation from me. It's in him.
Well, John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Angela, anything you want to respond
to
that?
Yeah, it's funny. When I was talking to Jane Golden and I asked her about her childhood, I mean, she does remember being an extremely gritty little girl, and those memories go back as early as she has memories. So that's absolutely true that, you know, some kids are born with an inclination in one direction or another, and in some cases parents just sort of like stand back and marvel without a lot of intercession, you know, that this kid grows up and is so determined and so passionate. But I think that shouldn't obscure the very important role that experience does have. I mean, Jane also told me that her parents were so supportive, right? You know, and they could have been otherwise. You know, when she wanted to do crazy things like, you know, enter that art competition one more time and, you know, call back that person one more time, they could have discouraged her. They could have made it impossible for her to do that, but they didn't. So, you know, parents do play a role no matter who their kids are genetically.
Jonna, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Well, in your family, you have something called the hard thing rule. I'll have you describe it.
Yeah, you know, I had my kids early in my graduate career. I mean, I really grew up as a scientist at the same time as I was growing up as a mother. I was actually pregnant with my second daughter and nursing the first in my first year of graduate school. And so all these questions, you know, how do we understand grit and how do we understand self-control? I took them all home with me and I thought about them as my own kids were growing up before my eyes. And here's what we do in the Duckworth family. You know, we're trying to balance, on the one hand, the fact that, you know, hard work does not come naturally. You know, there's no animal on this planet that, you know, voluntarily works hard on, you know, for its own sake. You know, that would not be adaptive. So kids really do need to learn to work hard, and they need their parents to do that. On the other hand, and here's the balance that every parent knows is difficult, you also want to give your kids autonomy, choice. You don't want to impose your own wishes upon them forever because you know that that's not good for them. The hard thing rule in our house has three parts. The first is realize that everyone, including mom and dad, have to do a hard thing. That's something that takes deliberate practice, the kind of practice that really makes you better and is very effortful and not always fun. The second thing is, you have to finish what you begin. And if you ask me, what's the single most predictive item on my entire scale? It is number 6. I finish whatever I begin. We don't let our girls quit in the middle of the track season. We don't let them quit before the tuition payment is up. We only let them quit when there's a natural stopping point, when they have fulfilled their commitments to their teachers and to us. But the third thing is, you can quit. You can quit when the tuition payment is up or the traction, but that next thing that you do, nobody gets to choose your hard thing but you. And that's where we let our kids to have some freedom. And I will tell you that even when they were in kindergarten, we let them choose their hard thing.
And what was your hard thing? Or what is your hard thing?
Well, I have two hard things, but really it's one. I mean, my major hard thing is being a scientist, trying to figure out how to help kids grow up well, right? Everything in my life, everything is to help kids thrive using psychological science. My second hard thing is really just it's far in second place, which is yoga. And you know, when I go to yoga, I really try to improve, and I've been doing it for years. And you know, that would be the other hard thing. But that's mine. And my husband kind of jokes that he's in real estate, and if there isn't a hard thing about real estate, he hasn't discovered it. So those are our respective hard things.
Interesting. You mentioned the word quit, and you write a fair amount about quitting in here. I mean, that there are reasons to quit doing something. It's not fulfilling. It's not all the things you expected it to be. And it sounds like early on, even in your career, it's not like you were quitting various different jobs, but you did a number of different things before realizing that you wanted to be a psychologist.
Well, I did fulfill my commitments. I mean, I didn't quit when I was a teacher. I didn't, quit before June, which actually unfortunately happens. In fact, I have a study of teachers where that is what we're looking at. Who are the teachers who quit before the end of the school year? And some do. And no surprise, it is the less gritty teachers who do exactly, they walk out on their students before the end of the school year. I never did that, but I'm not a teacher anymore, and I'm not a management consultant.
Right.
So I quit a number of things. It was like dating. I was quitting my jobs so that I could find my calling. And I think the same thing is when I had boyfriends. I was like, oh, we're not getting married. Bye. So, I think it was quitting with an intention to find something that I wouldn't want to quit.
And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Angela Duckworth, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's got a new book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, and she has done lots of research on things like grit and success and probably failure as well. 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Angela Duckworth is our guest. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's been a guest on Radio Times several times over the last couple of years, talking about grit, something that she received a MacArthur Fellowship for, her research on grit. And now she's got a new book, and it's called Grit, of all things, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. One of the things I want to make sure that our listeners understand, and this is from reading some of your book here, which is especially, let's say you're 14, 15 years old, it's hard to feel excited about, your math class or your science class or history or whatever. It's really the extracurricular activities, which is where this stuff shows up.
So many young people find their passion outside of the classroom. That doesn't mean I don't think they should do their homework or be as engaged as students as possible. But there are so many of us. I mean, think about yourself. I can think about myself. Like, I was so excited about doing tutoring and community service when I was in high school. And I went to the Cherry Hill Public Schools my whole life, got an excellent education, had so many opportunities to, exercise those interests, to deepen those interests. To me, the great sin, or one of them anyway, these days, is that it's our least advantaged kids who have the least opportunity to develop those interests outside of the classroom because their school doesn't have enough money for sports, or they've decided to increase the standardized testing practice and decrease time to the school play or the newspaper. That, to me, is a great disservice because in many ways, those extracurriculars are the playing fields of grit. That's where we practice our passion and our perseverance.
We were talking during the break, you have kids in the public schools here in Philadelphia and sort of living the budget crisis, but raising questions about where that investment of limited dollars then goes.
We moved from Narberth, Pennsylvania, which many of your listeners will know is just outside, but it's a very, very, you know, comfortable suburb, to Center City, Philadelphia a few years ago. And the year that we did that, and we, you know, sent our kids to Masterman, which is an excellent Philadelphia public school, the year that we did that, you know, our kids come home from school the first week, and they have this, like, memo that says, you know, you have to get your kids out of the school building by the last bell because we don't have enough money, you know, not only just to open the library, which they had to close because there wasn't a librarian there for the year, but we don't have enough money for the security guard to keep the doors open, so the kids have to be out of the building. And my kids were like, oh my gosh, like, this isn't Kansas anymore. So absolutely, and I think that, you know, for most of our listeners, I mean, we're all so privileged. It's hard to remember or to just know that advantages are not, you know, meted out equally. And I think that, you know, the thing about grit is it's not that we should just say that kids should be gritty and therefore we don't have to devote resources. It kind of gets back to what we were talking about early. Kids should be gritty and therefore we need to devote more resources.
Let me get Jason from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Jason, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I appreciate what you do, Angela. Sure. It's awesome. I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher for 9 years, and I left the classroom because for two reasons. One, to follow my passion, to take kids abroad, to do service immersion work. And the second reason, because I always felt like school was not really, it was almost purposeless to take tests and do things like that. And when I took kids abroad, I actually saw what you're talking about, which is, like, this end goal that is bigger than they ever imagined. And when they did it, they realized that the failures were just as important as the successes. And school was kind of not really teaching to that. It was more about the one and done, or it died on my desk because I was a teacher. So things went to my desk and then it just ended there. It didn't really go on beyond that. So I wanted to teach things that went on beyond that. And the goal of abroad really, really brought that grittiness home. Once they earned it.
Well, Jason, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You're nodding your head, Angela Duckworth.
One of the programs I appreciate most in Philadelphia is called Summer Search, and it does exactly what you're talking about, which is taking kids who haven't been abroad. I mean, there are kids in this city who haven't even been out of their zip code, right? I mean, talk about, you know, the perspective that they're able to have. And I absolutely agree that, you know, it's on those trips, or, you know, in a sports team, or, you know, it's so often those experiences outside the classroom that broaden that perspective, that allow them to see goals that they would never have been able to dream without having those life experiences.
You had mentioned some research looking at teachers who aren't able, for whatever reason, to complete the academic year. You also looked at West Point, and there's a, I mean, these are high achievers, but about a 20% dropout rate, I guess, in that first year, trying to figure out what is it about, I guess, the people that don't make it through, and what is it about the people that do? What did you find?
So West Point Military Academy, as some listeners will know, is, you know, the elite academy for developing officers. About 25% of the officers for the U.S. Army come out of West Point. It's incredibly hard to get in. You know, many, many, many of the cadets are valedictorians. Almost all of them are varsity athletes. The majority varsity athlete captains. I mean, these are no small feats. And it's true that over the course of 4 years, there's a dropout rate that can be as high as 20%. A lot of those dropouts happen in the very first summer. And what's remarkable to me about studying that first summer is, you know, you just spent 2 years trying to get into this place and you drop out within the first 2 months. You know, what's going on there? And what we find is that it is the grittier cadets, the grittier men and women who are more likely to make it through what West Point calls BEAST, which is their nickname. Actually, it's their official name for the first summer of training. You know, one of the psychologists that I started this research at West Point with is named Mike Matthews, and he himself had gone through Air Force training. It's similar in that, you know, you enter something where for the first time in your life, you're below average. For the first time in your life, you're being asked to do things that you can't do. And it's really hard. And his observation as a young man was that it wasn't necessarily the most athletic kids who made it. It wasn't necessarily necessarily the smartest kids. You know, it was the ones who actually stuck it out and said, you know what, I'm going to finish this.
Does that surprise you, though? I mean, that seems intuitive.
Yeah, you know, to some extent, I am surprised that the most able individuals don't work harder or don't show up. You know, Woody Allen has this very famous quote, 80% of success in life is showing up. And if you ask about the context of that quote, he was being interviewed by William Safire at the New York Times. And the interview was about what advice Woody Allen had for young writers. And he said, you know, there's so many able people, and they all told me that they're writing a book, but how many of them finish it? If you don't finish what you start, then you've kind of struck out at the very first level. And it is surprising that those for whom the odds are the best of being successful because they're so able, that they do strike out at the first level by not finishing things, by not working as hard as they could. It's something I still need to research, honestly, to answer why exactly that is.
I mean, thinking that it'll come naturally or perhaps being rewarded, praised for being so smart?
I think that's my prevailing hypothesis. And, you know, if you look at a lot of successful people and you ask them, you know, why do you think that the most able kids aren't always the ones who work the hardest? You know, they say, well, maybe they haven't had to, you know, I mean, none of us would grow up unless we had to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get more practice kind of dusting yourself off when you do fall down occasionally. And if you don't fall down a lot, it's hard for you to do that.
So there's, I mean, such a cliche here, but so many lessons from failure, right?
You know,
I mean,
I know.
We focused a lot on success, but it seems...
Cliches are cliche for a reason.
Yeah.
It's because they're true, and so we keep repeating them, and then we sort of, you know, beat the life out of them. But, you know, there's truth in every cliche, really. And the idea of, you know, fail forward, or, you know, there's all of success is paved with fail. You know, these are very, very true statements. And I'll tell you that, you know, there isn't a coach or a CEO or a teacher that I've talked to who doesn't say that the secret to really being a high achiever is to be able to learn from your victories the same way that you learn from your failures. It's information. Just the other day, I was talking to Brad Stevens. I get these like crushes on coaches, and I have a crush on Brad Stevens. He's the coach of the Celtics. And he said, you know, that is the singular thing he's looking for from his players, and is the singular thing he's trying to do himself as a coach who wants to be better, which is, how do I take everything that happens as information to learn from? So many of us walk around, you know, am I a winner or am I a loser? We should all walk around thinking, I'm a learner.
Huh. Let me read an email from Eric. Eric says, isn't grit really forcing yourself to do things you have no quote unquote passion for? I hate cleaning, so live neck deep in dust and mildew because I don't have the grit to clean the grit out of my apartment. But he's saying, isn't grit really doing the thing you really don't like as opposed to the thing that you do like?
You know, part of grit is actually putting up with things that you don't like, but only, and this is really important, only if that's in service to some top-level goal that you find uniquely meaningful and important. I'll give you a very specific example. One of the paragons of grit that I studied for my book and for my research is Rowdy Gaines. He won the 1984 100-meter freestyle and set a world record. And he said to me, when I asked him, do you like to practice swimming? He said, oh, do you mean do I like to wake up at 4 or 4:30 in the morning when it's dark out, put on a swimming suit, jump into a cold pool, and swim so hard that my heart feels like it's going to explode? Do I like that? Is that what you're asking? No, I didn't like to practice, but I had an overall passion for swimming, for the sport, for competing, for winning, for having teammates. There's nothing I love more than swimming, even if I don't love the practice. So to your point about cleaning your house, I don't know, that might not be part of your top-level goal, in which case I don't think grit is relevant.
We have a tweet from Chris saying, are we impeding grit development with such things as no score, kids sports, and discouraging competitiveness, raising the question about, is there a role of competitiveness when it comes to grit?
For some people, competitiveness does drive their grit. You know, athletes tell me this a lot, and a lot of people in business tell me that they're, you know, they like to win, you know, and, you know, it matters to them that they're number one and somebody else is number two. But I wouldn't say that's true of the artists that I've met or the musicians who are really gritty, and they don't find that competition and being the last person standing is what drives them. All that said, if we ask the question, or if you ask me as a psychologist, do we need to say that there's no score in this soccer game? I mean, is it such a terrible thing to tell kids that your team lost or you came in eighth place, so no, you don't get a ribbon? I don't think we should be afraid of doing that because, you know, in a way, we're depriving people of feedback. And feedback is important for learning, and feedback is essential to getting better. So yeah, a kid should know that my team lost, and then they should think about why they lost, and part of that is luck, and part of it is the other team. But, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of telling kids that they're not number one all the time.
It's funny you say that, because I remember when my son was little and played Little League, and they didn't have scoreless competition, but the kids knew the score.
Oh my gosh,
the
they always know.
They always knew if they won or lost. It was kind of cute, but
kind of cute and kind of like a New Yorker cartoon, right? It's like so absurd. But there's a soccer field across where we used to live when we lived in the suburbs in Narberth. It's right in front of our house, and you know there was one of these scoreless soccer games going on, and I remember walking up to one of these kids. They were like 6 years old, and I said, "Oh, you know, what's the score?" And they said, "Well, we're not supposed to know." And then they said to me, "But don't tell the coach. They're winning 5-4. You know, they know. We should. They're tougher than we think."
Let me get Andrew from Chesapeake City to join us. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I just love the show. I just wanted to say.
Thank you.
I'm an 18-year-old student going to school, and when I was in high school, I found that my school really lacked a lot of time to give extracurricular activities. And I found that a lot of where I found my grit, you know, comes from the teachers and how important they have to really inspire their kids, because there's not really enough money. There wasn't enough money in my school system to really allow me to flesh out what I wanted to do or where I could go with my life. So I think that a lot of it needs to come from the teachers if the money can't come in itself.
Well, Andrew, I'm glad you called in, and I'm glad you listened to Radio Times. It's terrific to hear from 18-year-olds, especially with the kind of experience that you were just talking about yourself, Angela, with your children. And it's for a lot of children, not just in poor communities, but also I think in a lot of more well-heeled communities, just this focus on academics to the detriment of almost anything else.
I think it's still Teacher Appreciation Week, actually, right? And that's a terrific, you know, thing to bring up here, which is the importance of teachers. And so much of what teachers do is outside of the formal curriculum. I mean, I can remember my most meaningful, you know, the teachers who had the greatest impact on me, you know, Mrs. Fallon, who taught me grammar in eighth grade, and Mr. Carr, who taught me to love language and so forth. But I not only remember what Mr. Carr taught me about, you know, how to write a topic sentence and how to close a paragraph. You know, Mr. Carr taught me to love learning. Mr. Carr taught me that, you know, any revision was better than the last one, but could be yet improved still with more feedback and more effort. I mean, Mr. Carr was such a hard teacher. I mean, I once emailed all the people that I could remember who were in our English class together, because Mr. Carr was retiring from the Cherry Hill schools. And I thought, my gosh, I'll try to find these people and maybe they'll remember Mr. Carr. No person that I emailed didn't immediately email me back within 15 minutes with a long, long story about how this man, this teacher, changed their life forever. One person had still in his wallet, and took a photo of it on his phone and sent it to me. In his wallet, he had a little poem that Mr. Carr had given us once in English class. This is like over 25 years ago. And it was yellow with age and it was folded up. And it's because teachers have the most important job in society. And I hope, as a former teacher, that we elevate them to the status that they deserve to be, like they are in other countries.
We're almost out of time here, but you also make a point in the book, which is, you know, greatness is great, but goodness might be better. Or is better, perhaps.
I made a big life decision in the last year, and that is that a nonprofit that I started while I was also a professor, it's called the Character Lab, and its mission is to advance the science and practice of character development. The big decision was that I would move this nonprofit operation from New York to Philadelphia, to the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and that I would take it on as a scientific director. It was a momentous decision for me because it means that my job is now not only to think about grit and self-control, control as a researcher who directly studies those things, but as somebody who needs to foster the science and practice of gratitude, curiosity, emotional intelligence, integrity. You know, we don't only want our kids to be great and successful people, we want them to be good people. And that's just as important, if not more so, when we talk about character.
Angela Duckworth, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. And she is a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.